Looks like you had Erica Jung.
She's invited me to a party for some reason.
Oh, that should be fun.
As a matter of fact, I am going to. I haven't talked to her yet.
Look at that. She knows how to make herself well known.
That's right.
There's no question about it.
And the return card is: will I sport? Will I kiss? If I won't sport, I won't. I don't even know what a sport.
I mean, she's become famous for sleeping with everyone. That's really what it is.
You're on tape.
That's right. I wouldn't want to make an enemy.
It's strange. I was talking to her former father-in-law, Howard Fast, the other day. I'm going to a party.
Howard Fast is. Oh yes, she married his son.
Jonathan Fast.
Yeah.
Howard Fast told me that the publisher called him. They had the same publisher at the time. He was out in Los Angeles, and asked if, since Erica didn't know anybody in Los Angeles, would he meet her perhaps and take her around. So Howard said he sent his son Jonathan to the airport to meet Erica. By the time they got home, they were in love. Now, of course, if you've been following the what's been going on, they have each charged each other with harassment. She apparently used the name of her daughter in a book about a children's book of divorce. He filed suit. I believe it was Random House. Stopped publication, made her change the title, and she sued the publisher for delaying the book, and then she sued her husband for harassment, and then the husband countersued for harassment.
And before he met her at the airport, he was a perfectly harmless young lawyer or something, wasn't he?
Was he a lawyer?
I don't know what he was. I don't know what he was, but
he's a novelist, Jonathan Fast. He wrote his last novel was called The Beast. And he's not a bad novelist, but in her new book, Erica, which is called Parachutes and Kisses or something, I think.
Join our most kissable contest. Perform astounding feats of aerial daring do. I'm sorry you haven't been to this, so you could tell me about it.
I'm not sure I'm going to go.
See, people will go because of this. Who's her publisher?
Her publisher is who? I don't remember.
I read an interview with her recently in which the
NAL.
She said she just couldn't understand why people were down on her because all she was doing was just what men have been doing for centuries, and she's sort of moving into the kind of Mae West position. And she's developing the figure to go with it, I guess.
She certainly has done a number, as they say, on her husband and her ex-husband in her new book. She portrays him as a trivial novelist, not very successful. Well, it's another war between the Tates.
Oh, they were much nicer to each other.
They were much more civilized, that's
much
true.
Much more civilized.
Well, let's talk a bit, because I know you have things to do.
And you have someone coming in.
I don't, there are some things I want to cover that we didn't cover the last time you were here, because we talked primarily about the message in your book, The Language of Clothes. But I want to find out a little bit more about you now, and before we lead up to your new book, Foreign Affairs, which I thought was a marvelous book. I found it very hard to put down. You were born in Chicago. You were raised in White Plains. And I'd like to know a little bit about your background. Give me some idea what you were like as you grew up, because that obviously had an impact on what you are today and the kind of writer you are today.
Well, I was a small, skinny, plain child, very poor at games, and therefore I became a great reader. My childhood has something in common with that of the heroine of my latest book, Vinnie Minor, in that I had a very happy childhood and enjoyed everything about it. And as I say in the book, people who have a very happy childhood and rather a miserable adolescence often want to return to childhood because it was a happy time of their life.
And indeed, Vinnie in Foreign Affairs is a teacher of children's literature, as are you at Cornell.
That's true. That's one of the things I teach.
You say you were bookish as a child. Were you also a child who did some writing?
Well, all children write verses and stories, and my mother encouraged me and praised me, as I think most mothers do. And I enjoyed it. I I didn't think at the time that I was all that different from other children, but I went on with it, whereas other children perhaps stopped.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a lot of friends as a child?
Oh, yes, I did.
What was your adolescent period like for you?
Well, my early adolescence was unhappy because I left the small progressive school I'd been going to and went to a big high school where I was completely confused and frightened. And so I had two very bad years. Then I went away to boarding school, and I was happy again.
Where did you go to boarding school?
It was a school called Cherry Lawn in Connecticut that no longer exists.
After boarding school, you went to Radcliffe.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of experience was Radcliffe for you?
Oh, very nice. It was. I don't know what it's like now, but it was a small school then, I think only about 1,000 students. And yet we were able to go to Harvard classes. It was during the war. The war was still on when I first got there. And so it was perhaps unusual in that Cambridge was full of young men in uniform studying in the Navy program or the Army program. And it was kind of an exciting time to be there.
Have you had a chance to read Alice Adams' new book, Superior Women, yet?
I haven't yet, but if you've interviewed her, you may know that she and I were in the same writing class when we were in college.
No, I didn't know that. Were you contemporaries in college?
Yes, she's a couple years ahead of me. Let's not say that. Yes, we were contemporaries in college. I know she doesn't like to say how old she is. Yes, we were contemporaries at college, and we were in the same writing seminar. It's a famous writing seminar because in this class of, I think, 10 or 11 people, four have become fairly well-known writers, not only Alice and me, but also Steve Becker and, oh, hell, what's the name of that man? He wrote, Steve Becker and Michael Crichton.
Yes.
Michael Crichton? No. Who's the man he wrote?
Michael Crichton's too young to have been.
He's too young. Michael, what is his name? I'll do this over again. He wrote The Secret of Santa Victoria. Michael, what is his name? Oh, bother. I knew it a moment ago.
Didn't you dedicate Foreign Affairs? Yes, to Diane Johnson.
Yes.
Yeah, she's a friend of Alice Adams in San Francisco.
That's right.
Mm. Matter of fact, Diane Johnson was here not too long ago. Well, maybe it was 2 years ago. She just written a biography of Hammett.
That's right. Very good biography.
Excellent. Yes. Mm-hmm. Who conducted the seminar, the writing seminar you were in?
Albert Girard. And it only ran for a couple of years because then he went to Stanford. But even so, he was a wonderful teacher and made a tremendous impact on the Harvard writing program. Since then, they have had a writing seminar, and many good writers have come out of it.
What was your major when you were at Radcliffe?
I was in history and literature.
What was your goal as you were to graduate?
Well, of course I wanted to be a writer, but I knew I'd have to get a job, so I came to New York and worked for the Oxford University Press. Then I got married, and for some time I followed my husband around, first when he went to graduate school in Cambridge and at Harvard, and then to Amherst, and then to Los Angeles, and then back east to Cornell.
He was teaching?
First he was studying, then he was teaching.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like Alice Adams' story, almost exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't do any writing, you became, in effect, a...
Oh, no, I was constantly writing, and I published some when I was in college and just afterwards. But then I started to write novels, and I wrote two novels I couldn't publish. And so I had about 10 years when I was having babies and not getting published. Then I was lucky again, and I wrote a third novel, and it was published. That was Love and Friendship.
Tell me about that novel and how that came about. What year was that?
Oh, I'm so terrible on dates. Wait a minute.
1962.
All right, must have been 1962. I had written a memoir of a friend of mine who died, and I'd just written this for my own pleasure because I wanted to remember her, and I knew if I didn't, I'd forget.
That was the poet Lang.
Yes, Bunny Lang. And a lot of people wanted to see it for all the other friends of hers. And some of her friends thought there should be more of them, so they paid to have copies printed up. And one fell into the hands of an editor at Macmillan, who wrote and asked me if I had ever written a novel. So I was just finishing a third novel, and as soon as I was done with it, I sent it to him, and he printed it.
What happened to those original two novels? Are they still in a drawer?
They're in the drawer. In fact, further away, they're in a box in a basement. I don't think they'll ever get out.
What happened after Love and Friendship? What kind of reception did that book have?
Well, it had a few rather good reviews, but nothing that anyone would notice. However, it was quite successful in England and got quite a lot of play there. And for a while, I was much better known in England than I was here.
Were you still, were you teaching at this point, 1962?
No, I didn't start teaching until 1970.
At Cornell?
At Cornell.
Mm. Was that your first teaching job?
Yes, it was.
And you've been there ever since?
Ever since. Mm-hmm.
And periodically turning out novels?
Yes, well, you see, I'm on half time now, so I can write 8 months of the year.
Mm. How do you do it? How do you approach your writing? Do you sit down and say, look, I've got a great idea here and I'm going to carry it through? Do you write spontaneously? How do you organize yourself? Exactly how does it work for you?
Well, I think in different ways. I mean, often I'll carry an idea around for years before I can find the situation and the characters that will go with it. For instance, in this new book, Foreign Affairs, began with the idea that one way people can change and grow is to move from the world they're familiar with into a strange world. And I had this idea, but I didn't have the characters for it, and I didn't have the strange world, because the only worlds I'd lived in were one academic town after another. And it wasn't until I got to know London through spending time there and got to know people in England that I saw that this was another world in which people, Americans, could go into and change. And I still didn't have the idea for the book until I had another idea, which was that life is not necessarily over for people at 50, that people can still be surprised, can still be excited, can still change and have experiences that they never imagined could be theirs. And I wanted to write about this because I thought that the fiction of the past and the media of the present are telling us the opposite thing, that we see older people only as secondary characters. They're around, but they're in the background, and they stand for something, but they never change. Nothing really happens to them. Well, they may get ill or die, and they may do something that affects a younger hero or heroine, as parents, as bosses, or whatever. But most of the time, it's assumed that anyone over 50, their life is finished. They are what they're going to be for the rest of their life. And I think that maybe 100 years ago, this was a reasonable way of thinking, because so many people were old at 50, so many didn't live much longer. But now it's possible to go on and be healthy and energetic for another 20 years, maybe more. It's unreasonable and boring to go on repeating the same character, the same gestures, and the same job all that time.
Ah. Thank God you're telling me that, Allison, because I'm almost 50 now, and I was almost ready to pack it in. You've given me new hope.
I don't believe that for one moment. No, I mean, it's not sophisticated people like you who you see so much of the world, you know that there are other possibilities, because you see people who are over 50 and things are happening to them. But my heroine, who lives in a small college town and doesn't know the world the way you do, is more affected by this also because she's a woman. The more so because I think it's harder for women than men.
You're not a kleptomaniac, are you, Allison?
No. If I were a kleptomaniac, I would conceal it. I mean, any crime I may have committed will not appear in my fiction.
There are echoes of foreign affairs in the war between the Tates. Obviously, your characters come from Corinth University. Mm-hmm. I'm pronouncing that correctly? Corinth?
Mm-hmm.
Freddie Turner makes an appearance in the war between the Tates, but I think he has mentioned very briefly.
Yes, he's the child of Freddie Turner is mentioned in the war between the Tates, but he does appear in Love and Friendship, my first novel, and where he is the child of the heroine, and he causes quite a lot of trouble because even though he's only 4 years old, he senses that his mother is having an affair with this man who keeps turning up in the house. And he and the lover have a very antagonistic relationship. I put him into this book because I had some sense of what he was like as a child and of the background he came from. And I suppose you could say, in a way, it was laziness because I didn't have to invent his past. I already knew it.
Same thing is true with Rue.
That's right. She appears in The War Between the Tates, and where she's the daughter of the best friend of the heroine, and she's one of these little girls who's mad about horses. And again, I know the world that she comes from, and in fact, the idea of putting her into the book came to me first because, of course, she's connected with this imaginary town, Corinth.
I also have the feeling, I could be wrong here, but I have the feeling that the veterinarian in The War Between the Tates, his name escapes me, was perhaps an undeveloped prototype for Chuck Mumpson.
Yes, I think that's a very shrewd observation. I think Chuck is an exaggeration of the veterinarian. The veterinarian, after all, is a man who's teaching at Cornell. Well, excuse me. The veterinarian is a man who's teaching at a major university. He presumably has a doctorate, and he's lived in a college town, so he's a much more sophisticated man. He would never, I think, wear the kind of clothes that Chuck Mumpson wears that upset Vinny so much. I'm sure he doesn't own a green transparent plastic raincoat. But Chuck is an exaggeration of that side, I think.
You threw me off a little bit because with the title and foreign affairs and with Vinny off to England and making her, I think the first character she meets is Chuck Mumpson in the airplane. I thought for sure that I didn't think that Chuck Mumpson was going to play as big a role. I thought for sure that Vinny was going to wind up with Freddie somehow. There was going to be...
Oh, no, that's very... that could never have happened. I mean...
Well, that's what I thought was going to happen, but...
No, I mean, that would be... because... Fred has his choice of beautiful young women. Nothing like that could have happened.
England.
Besides, Vinny would have nothing to do with someone in her own a junior member of her own department. I mean, that would be like men in New York who sleep with file clerks. Only the most foolish person would do that.
Well, now, Allison, in fiction, anything could happen. For example, the literary critic who bombasted Vinny's work in children's literature turns out to be another character who was in The War Between the Tates. I can't remember his name, but it was...
L.D. Zimmern, yes.
Zimmern.
Yes, he's the character that's appeared in most of my novels, though he doesn't get much time, but
Well, that's quite a coincidence.
Oh, yes. Well, you see, yes, it is, but it's perhaps the only coincidence I've allowed so far, and it's not too unusual, because L.D. Zimmern writes a great many unfavorable articles because he's rather a cross person, rather sardonic. When you think of Dickens or Thackeray or Trollope or any of the famous 19th century novelists, what they do with coincidence is far more shocking than what I've done here.
You live part of the time in England?
No, I try to spend at least a month there every year, but I don't live there.
Of course, a couple of the characters, again, I can't remember the names, the Zieglers? The friends of Freddy's.
The Voglers.
The Voglers,
sorry. Oh, you can't be expecting with all this stuff.
At any rate, the Voglers, of course, are extremely, they're hypercritical of England. And, of course, Vinnie is very protective of her almost adopted country.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your feelings toward London.
I think I've felt both things, and I think I'd have to have done so in order to write about it. There have been moments when I thought, what am I doing here? Why did I come to this cold, wet place? And there have been moments when I thought it was absolutely the most wonderful spot on earth.
As a teacher, do you also teach creative writing at the
Yes,
Cornell?
I do.
Mm. How do you teach creative writing? I have taken creative writing courses when I was in college, and the process was to read your stories in class, and then the class would, in effect, decimate the story. And
well,
I wondered about
that
approach a little bit, and I just wonder, you know, you can, teachers can be inspirations, and they can also be decimating.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't allow a destruction of the stories in my class, because I don't think that's helpful. I think that it's good for someone who wants to be a writer to be in a class like this, because then they can see what the effect of their stories will be on their contemporaries. Because what I think of a story isn't as important as what 12 or 15 other kids their age think, because that's their natural audience and those are the people who have had similar experiences. But I don't let them pick on each other, because that's purely destructive and depressing. On the other hand, I encourage them to criticize small things. I mean, I encourage them to say, I don't understand why she says this here, or I don't like that metaphor, or what happened here, but remarks like, that story is stupid, and I was bored, and I hate that kind of thing, are outlawed. And I tell them at the first class that anyone who makes these remarks will automatically receive the grade of C-.
Those are the kinds of remarks, though, one might expect of students, believe it or not, at a Ivy League college like Cornell, because you picture some of these students in the war between the Tates during the 1960s as oafs. You can often tell that because of their language. I can't remember all the examples of the kinds of slang that they used then, and probably use even to a greater degree now. But what are students like today? I mean, I would picture students at Cornell on a much higher level than, say, my alma mater, which was a state university.
Well, I think that's a delusion in itself, but students are much changed from the late 60s when the war between the Tates takes place. I read recently in the Times that people 18 to 24 are voting Republican in much greater numbers than people of any other age. And though this may shock you, it doesn't surprise me, because I've seen my students become more and more conservative over the last 5-6 years. And when I began to teach in 1969-70, I spent most of my time suggesting to the kids that it was worth reading things written before 1950, that it was worth studying, that the best poetry was perhaps not written under the influence of drugs, and that manners had some purpose. And so I was a conservative force. I now, the pendulum has swung to the so far in the other direction that I'm now the aging bohemian radical in my classes, and I have to encourage my students to take risks, not to accept everything they hear in class, to consider that there might be something to do with their lives after they graduate than choosing between business school and law school. And because I've lived long enough now, I know that it will swing back. But it's this is a particularly difficult period, I think, for anyone who has hope for the future and hasn't seen how these changes are ephemeral.
Mm. Well, Zanori, we're almost out of time, but I want to go back to a question that I put before you earlier, and I don't think you responded. Maybe I didn't phrase it very well. You are now teaching on a half-time basis at Cornell.
That's right.
So you have more time to do your own writing.
That's true.
How do you do this? Do you do this as a person would write, or as a person would work if he went to an office every day? Do you fix your own hours?
I usually work at home, but I only work on fiction 8 months of the year. When I'm teaching, I write reviews or articles, things that I need a library for, because Cornell has a wonderful library. And so I try to do my research and my scholarly work and my nonfiction books, if any, then. And then when I'm writing a novel, I can go anywhere. I can go to I can work in London. I can work at an artist's colony, or I can work if I go to Key West, I can work there. All I really need is a room with a door that shuts and a typewriter and a phone that can be disconnected.
You need something else, don't you?
What's that?
An idea?
Oh, yes. But as I said, I'm carrying these ideas around with me for years sometimes, and I often feel they just need time to develop.
The novel is in your mind, and that's a matter of sitting down at a typewriter and making it come out? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no. When I begin a novel, what I'll do first is make a lot of notes, and also they'll include notes for characters and scenes that might never appear in the finished product.
Alison Murray, I know you have another appointment, as I did. We covered a lot of ground in this 30 minutes or so we chatted. I thought Foreign Affairs was a wonderful novel. It was not a rushed book either. I noticed sometimes when I read, I get the feeling that the last portion of a novel sometimes is written more hastily than the first portion, as if the author is trying to finish it up fast. But I didn't get that impression. I felt that there was a consistent pace throughout the book.
I can explain this, I think, by saying that I have a policy never to accept in advance. If you accept an advance for a book, then the hot breath of the publisher will be felt upon your neck. And very often a book takes longer to complete than you have thought. But they're waiting for it, and they put it into the catalog, and you owe it to them. And I only once did I accept an advance for The Language of Clothes, and I learnt my lesson, very fortunately, on nonfiction. I know now never to take that kind of risk.
Oh, one last question. Are you a great reviser?
Oh, tremendously. I do 5-6 versions of everything.
Do you write the entire manuscript and then start from scratch again, or do you revise as you go?
No, both. I revise as I go, and when I finish, I start over.
Alison Murray, thank you very, very much for coming in and talking to me.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm.